David Bohm Seminar Series 1, November 8, 1987, 4 o'clock afternoon session, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California.
Is it ready now? I think we'll begin if there are four groups that are going to just state their questions they came to. Is that right? Number one. Oh, no, this is something else.
Peace, how is the best way to relate to the world as it is when one has thought out relationship? Should one relate best politically, or in what way do we change the world?
Right, how to relate to the world is the question, and to change it. Is that right? And that was group one, right? Group two?
What is the nature of the relationship of verbalizing and perception?
Relation of verbalizing and perception. Group two. And then group three?
How do you tell the difference between true and false values? You can't just set up a standard and compare psychological behavior to it, so how do you do it?
Yes,
one of our members said you can't.
Yes, that's some people are skeptical.
And what was the basic question without...
What?
This third group, three, what was the basic
question? How to distinguish between true and false values. Number four?
The group had a lot of discussion and had a bit of trouble formulating a question per se. The discussion centered around the development of the ego, and wasn't it actually quite natural for the ego to develop?
Yeah.
And is there some way to respond to the fact that it's such a natural development? And also, what instrument perceives the ego?
Yes. Isn't the ego natural, and what perceives it, and so on? Yeah, so I think that some of these questions I will answer, and I'll discuss, maybe the others will be partially answered. I mean, I'm not specifically trying to answer any questions, but I think that it will affect what I say. Now, I think one more point I would like to go on. We were discussing values, right? And I would like to bring in the question of value judgments, you see. Now, you can make a value judgment by saying this is good, that is bad, this is beautiful, this is strong, this is, this is important, this is great, this is terrible, right? No, this is repulsive. These are all value judgments, right? Now, notice that these judgments are very, very fast, right? You cannot see yourself making them. That's very important, right? Now, what is a judgment? You see, a judgment is a statement which, like saying, this chair has made of metal, right? This chair is metal, or this arm is metal, right? That's a very elementary judgment.
Is a judgment the same as a conclusion?
Well, conclusion goes through a series of judgments. It's a logical process of going from one judgment to the next, like a syllogism, they call it that. If you say, gold is a metal, all metals conduct electricity, therefore gold conducts electricity, right? Those are three judgments in a row make a conclusion. Now, that's called in logical terminology a syllogism. It won't help you to know that. But you have other, like gold is a metal is a judgment, right? And you can go on saying this is beautiful or this is ugly, or this being such and such an object is useful or serves its purpose, right? Or it doesn't serve its purpose. You see, now judgments may originally be based on perception, right? An expression of a perception in a logical form, right? but they then become sort of remembered and begin to react automatically, right? That is, your judgments may now come from thought, from memory. You see, at first they were thinking. You see, there's this distinction of thinking and thought. Thinking is a kind of active process where you're working it out, and then it goes on to the memory, becomes thought, which is the past participle of thinking. It has been thought, right? You have been thinking it. And then we say that is thought, but it's still active. We make an assumption that thought, when you finish thinking, it's gone, right? But it hasn't. It becomes thought, right? Whatever you have been thinking is thought. That's true grammatically. And the therefore, that's very important to notice that, because you may imagine that you're now free of it, that you finished thinking it. But in fact, it's thought. Now, if it happens to be a value judgment, then that's in your thought, right? And therefore, that value judgment now operates by disposing you to act in a certain way, right? Is that, And therefore, and that is very important, you see. Now, value judgments operate automatically and fast, so fast that you cannot tell they are judgments. And therefore, they are taken as perceptions of reality and true perceptions of reality. Because anything that fast which you do not see as thought, you tend to assume almost automatically that it must be perception and reality, right? That you have perceived.
Moving back a little bit, I can understand saying this is a metal chair. I mean, I don't see that as a judgment. I see metal as a fact, and the chair is a fact. Right. If I were to say it's an ugly metal chair, then judgment comes.
It's still out. A judgment. It's metal. It may only look like metal, you see. You say this is a metal chair. You're not saying what you actually perceive. You say, I perceive what appears to me to be a metal chair. That would be exactly what you see, right? But you have gone much further than what you see. By using the word is, you have made a judgment. You see the power of that word.
You say gold is a metal.
Well, gold is a metal. You see, you're saying the same thing. Gold is a metal. You see, now we're accepting all that from past experience, but we're saying that's it, right? What are you going to say, something?
There's judgment, and then there's value judgment.
Yeah, well, then value judgment saying this is ugly, right? You could say this strikes me as ugly, or it appears to me ugly, or something, but the judgment says this is ugly, or this is bad, right?
We interpret the word judgment to mean some kind of value.
Yes.
Well, usually we most often use it as value, but when you're doing a job, somebody says use your judgment. You see, judgment means to be critical, to be to divide.
I think that's what it means, is to be able to discern.
Yeah, but you have discerned something. Do you see if this is a metal and not wood, right?
What about love and hate? That's a judgment.
What?
That's opinion. Love and hate. Everybody says one must love, but I always say that's the chatter of opinion.
Well, a lot of judgment.
I think one should chatter with one's opinion. I think there should be just the fact.
Yes.
An opinion about the fact.
Yes, a lot of judgments are based on opinion. They may not be facts, you see. If you say, well, in politics, for example, a great many judgments are made which may not be facts. I mean, and I think we hardly need to illustrate it. Why?
You found that out.
You see, a judgment is not necessarily a fact. It depends on what it's based on. If you perceive a fact and state it correctly, it will be a judgment will express the fact. But when it comes to other things, your judgment may only be the automatic value judgment that you make by habit, right?
And therefore, how does one relate to the world if everybody is wrapped up in their own opinion about facts rather than concentrating on facts that we have to face?
Yes, well, I think we should defer that question, you see, because we're trying to go more deeply as to why we're caught in this, you see. That's why is everybody caught in doing all that and in making judgments. You see, I'm saying that people cannot help make these judgments which are not facts but are treated as facts, right? Now, that's because the way the whole thought process works. Now, particularly with value judgments, you see, that you're not so much danger by judging that this is a metal. It may be a mistake. It may only look like a metal. It'll be painted to look like it. Or it may shine like a metal and not be one. Or it may be of yellow metal, which is not gold. You may judge it to be gold. That would be a bad mistake, possibly. And the point is that that sort of mistake, though, it really is not the major problem that troubles us. If that were the only kind of mistake we made, we'd be all right. The mistakes, the serious mistakes, are mistakes about values, right? because they move us. You see, even the gold mistake is serious because gold is valuable, right? The value is us who give it value. Intrinsically, it doesn't have a value in itself, or even for us, it has real value, less than iron, say. But for one reason or another, people have come to give gold high value, and therefore mistakes about gold can cause a lot of trouble. Now, so if even with this gold example, it was still a question of value. That mistakes in value are a big problem, because they move us, you see. If it's gold, many people will be moved to get hold of it, you see. See, if you say there's gold in those hills, you have vast crowds of people coming to get it. If they said it turns out to be iron pyrites, they all go away.
Metal is not valuable to wear for the simple reason. Take my earrings, which are metal, gold. If I were caught in a fire, they'd get red hot. They're a good conductor of heat. And my ears would get burnt from just wearing... Now, if I were to have a bad conductor of heat, it wouldn't have any value money-wise, but it would have a value to my life.
Yes, that's quite right.
By looking at facts, your value system can then get oriented properly.
Yes, that's quite right. And the problem only is the ability to look at facts, you see. That this is where the trouble is. You see that we have we are unable to look at facts because the value judgments operate automatically. See, if somebody sees somebody who's against whom he's prejudiced, the value judgment comes up immediately about that person is somehow wrong or bad or whatever it is. Seeing a person of another race or religion or nation or shape of head or whatever you don't like his expression, you make a value judgment. Say that means that he is X, right? He is bad. He is stupid. He is one of those foreigners. He is whatever, right? You see, it's a judgment and it's a value judgment, right? It's a judgment as to what. And judgments are always as to what is, right? Now the point is that happens very quickly, and the person sees it so fast that it's attributed and projected into the real perception, and the perception of reality, and you experience that way, so that before anything can be done, it's already there, it has worked, and the person doesn't know it's worked, he takes it to be a real perception, and therefore he acts accordingly, right? And then he may then show hostility, and the other person will react back, and it builds up. So I'm saying there we have value judgments. And you see, value judgments are not a terribly good source of values. But they are the principal source of values that is operating. So, I would say some perception of value is needed, or some ultimate greater source of value is needed, you see, because you say, here is a problem. If we have a value, let's say telephones are useful, have value because you can talk from one person to another, right? And then you ask, what is the use of one person talking to another? There may not be no value in that. I mean, it depends on what they have to say, right? That was what Thoreau said, that he was told that with the electric telegraph, which had just been invented, a person in Boston could talk directly to a person and send a message directly to a person in Texas. So Thoreau said he didn't know anybody in Boston who had anything so important to say that it shouldn't be sent to Texas right away. So the point is that the value of the telephone depends, it's the same as that web of mistakes. See, the value depends on a whole web and structure of values, right? And so you'll never get to the end of that, right? You can never find the ultimate value on which that rests. You see, if life loses its meaning, then none of this has any value, right? And that is an old, old story, as we said in the Bible and so on, that it happens, right? So so we have all this question of there's no foundation apparently for values, and we, in place of a foundation, we get our values out of value judgments, which are based on our conditioning, clearly, and the whole past history of the human race, and so on. And that is really, there's no reason why a value judgment should give you a correct information about values. any more than you might as well get it out of your computer, you see. Probably more reliably. could make a list of values and press the button and get your value.
So you're saying the major distinction in values is between whether it's a perception of value versus a value judgment, which is a product of...
See, let's say we're viewing a work of art, you see, and trying to determine its value. a common occasion among some people. And how do we judge it? We say we've got to judge its value. Everybody says so. And you see, you might say, I have a tremendous amount of experience judging art, and I use that to judge the value, you see. And I say, well, I know that this is what people will buy, and that's not what they'll buy, and so on, you see. But you see, if it came to really judging it from the beginning, you would have to perceive that work of art and understand it, right, in a way which is not mechanical. Now, when new kinds of art appear, people don't know how to judge it, right? And they are inclined to say it's rubbish, like with the Impressionists. There were really riots when that first came out. And then later they say, okay, it has high value, we'll pay it. And then that painting which sold for, say, $5 or something in the beginning now sells for $5 million. And the point is, how do these values get determined, you see? I mean, is it just everybody finally agrees that, you know, that Cézanne was a great artist and therefore we're going to pay a lot of money for his pictures, showing our appreciation of its value? Is there something more to it than that?
Most minds, the value would be the fact that somebody would pay $5.
Yeah, well, that shows the superficiality of the whole mind.
It's an arbitrary.
Well, what changed the value of that painting from the beginning to the end?
Well, nothing. That change of value is obviously has no great meaning, right? But I'm trying to say, was there some value in the painting as a work of art? Take the difference between, say, Rembrandt. Suppose you don't like the Impressionists. Well, you may prefer a person like Rembrandt or Leonardo, right? We say compare Leonardo to somebody else in that school who was a fairly reasonable painter, but, you know, would you see a difference of value?
Are we not asking whether that value would be arbitrary?
I don't know if it's arbitrary or not. You see, is it arbitrary? I don't know.
Well, then you're asking if there's an intrinsic value.
Or intrinsic perception of value, yes. You see, to say as a work of art, whatever it's supposed to do, that there's more value in that more than in, say, somebody who, you know, just does mediocre work, right?
Well, how about if we took, instead of two different painters, two different perceivers, we took a person from the West and a person from the East, and they perceive these two same paintings, would they give the same value?
Not necessarily, no, but perhaps after a while they wouldn't begin to agree, you know, if they were serious. Let's say, I mean, the people who value it because other people value it, we're not going to put them aside as not very serious, right? They're not really interested in art, right?
Well, I was thinking about someone like who made great pottery in the China or something.
Yeah.
Would be shown a painting by some great artist in the West. Would he perceive that as a great painting?
Well, he might have to learn something about how to look at it, you see, because, you see, he might not immediately perceive it, right? But
Does the value of judgment come from the known?
Well, the judgment, obviously, is the known because the judgment is based on the past, right?
Judgment is, I say that's a valuable painting because I know that it is highly
valued. Yes, that's one way to say I know that it's such and such a thing, and we know that's a syllogism, and we know things of that nature are very valuable, right?
Yeah.
Right. You see, that's one way of making judgments, that things of this category are very valuable. X is in this category, therefore X is very valuable.
We're asking about sort of a basic kind of value rather than an imposed value, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, also take a scientific theory. There's Einstein's theory, and maybe some other scientist, X, may have made a theory, you know, and somehow people may feel that one has a higher value than the other.
In that case, it would be the one that appealed more to the sense of reality, the sense of...
Well, also the whole inner structure of it, its consistency, its beauty, and so on, you see. It's a very similar question to the work of art.
It's like when Einstein's theory came out, the Germans said that it was some kind of conspiracy.
Yes, well... Well, that was, a distortion, you know. We're trying to say there is all sorts of distorted ways of looking at value, but I'm raising the question, are there some that are not? And we're not going to answer it, but I'm saying it's worth thinking about. Take a scientific theory, a painting, or take a beautiful view of nature or whatever. You see, compare it, let's say, to a bunch of shacks in a slum. And say, is this an arbitrary convention that you prefer this beautiful view to the shacks, or is it something more to it than that? You see. It just happens to appeal to you and the other one doesn't.
Of course, if you have
you don't have a place to live, and the shack is a roof, that might
be... Well, then it has use value, clearly. You see, we're not denying use value, right? But I'm trying to say use value is a fairly easy thing to settle, because if it works, it's useful. You easily decide whether something has use value. If it doesn't have, if it doesn't do what it's supposed to do, it has no use value. Right?
We can usually tell if something, a painting or a scene, is harmonious.
Yes, but harmony is a very subtle question. Right?
Yes, but one has a sense of it, generally.
Yeah, also the view of nature and so on.
Right.
And the whole scientific theory may have a harmony of its ideas. Right?
Right.
Mathematics may have that, right? Music may have it, right? So again, take Beethoven or take some mediocre composer, right, of that same period. See?
Chopin was derided as being dissonant when...
Yes, but so was Mozart, you see. I mean, people have a hard time, because they judge music by value judgments based on their past experience, they could not appreciate it, right? Now, but some people did appreciate it. And they were somehow listening to it without those value judgments.
Seeing often that it's a learned response.
I mean, often, but not always. You see, Beethoven had to write this stuff, and he therefore had to get out of his value judgments. And those who listened, some of them liked it very much. And the same with Mozart. He used combinations of notes which had previously been valued as dissonant, right? But he was able to bring them into the whole in a way which made a new harmony, right? Now, some people could perceive that and some couldn't, right? Some are stuck in their value judgments and said, we cannot see this. You know, and then with the artists, it was even worse. They got very angry, you see, saying, you are insulting our values, you know. I mean, that's one of the worst things you can do. And the there were almost nearly riot scenes, but they took art very seriously in those times, some people. Now, I'm saying just simply to indicate that there may be a perception of value that is not just a value judgment, right? And keep it in mind, that's all, you know. But we have...
Well, couldn't you call that quality rather than value?
But that quality is sensed as value, you see, as something powerful and good, beautiful. You know, harmonious. Harmony is sensed as value, you see, and...
Well, that word value seems to... bring
up already the... No, but we have to get freed from that, because value means strength and power. If you say all strength and power is to be associated to judgment and anything else not, then we're going to lose the strength and power which is in value, right? You see, people used to talk of value in a very good way, saying the eternal values, you know, the values of goodness and so on. And it was not intended to be a judgment. It may have been one because they couldn't help it, but the intention was not that, right?
Excuse me, but even today the dealers or the handlers of major artworks will say that they have to stand in front of the painting, and that certain feeling comes across. And another dealer or agent will agree that this feeling has to come across.
Yeah.
It isn't something that they can converse on.
No, it's not even it's very commercialized, but yet there is still something left of some value that they stand for, right?
But it seems to be more internal.
Well, you have to perceive it, you see, and feel it, right?
Beyond the words?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You see, I say that there are values that we can perceive beyond the word, which can then be put in words, which take the form, apparently, of judgments by saying, this is a very good painting, right? there's something behind it, beyond the word, right? But then if other people start repeating, this is a very good painting, and automatically the thought comes, this is a very good painting, you see. So, therefore we have to see how one slips into the other. And now that's an indication, you see. Now, let's come back to value judgments. The trouble about value judgments is they're so fast, right, that you can't tell they're not perceptions. See, the value judgment claims to be just the kind of perception of value that we were talking about. Exactly. That's why it's so why it creates illusion.
So we're saying that the one is where value is intrinsic, and the other where it's based on experience of the person who's...
Well, it's based on his past thought and so on, and on the thought of everybody. And this is based on direct perception, right? Now, but both look the same to the person who's experiencing it. You see, that's nobody would be fooled by a value, by words, by unless he felt that he was seeing something. You see, the words produce the impression of seeing something, right? As we've explained about the television set, right? So the now, so you've got these values, and the value judgments, right? Now, then value judgments are very fast, you see. Now, we're saying about anger, right? Can you suspend anger and look at anger and see the whole thing going on? Now, let's say you can suspend the activity of anger, but a very big part of anger is the thought, I have good reason to be angry. Now, in there appears the word good, which is a value judgment, right? That's where you're stuck, right? You see, you can see everything except the operation of the word good. Is that clear? That goes so fast, you don't see that, right? You seem to have perceived the goodness of your good reason. Now, if you have a good reason, one way is to see it's a good reason, you see. I mean, there are many cases where you do have good reasons, and you can see that it's a good reason. Now, what about this good reason to be angry? You see, have you seen that it is a good reason? You apparently have. But if you look, you see you haven't, right? And if you try to analyze the reason, you see usually it's not a good reason. Is that clear? I was saying, he did this and this and this to me, and therefore, I have a good reason, right? But the goodness of the good reason, see, the perception of what is reasonable and right is still the same as the artistic perception, finally. Is that clear? And the scientific perception of what is a right theory and so on. You can call it intuitive, or, you know, let's whatever. Some people call it intuitive, but you know, intuition often is used in another way of being a bit sentimental and vague and so on. I mean that this is a very clear, sharp perception, immediate, that this is reasonable, you see, that this is a good reason. Now, you can then explain it by analysis sometimes, right? It's not that you get to the reason by analysis, but rather the analysis explains and communicates the right reason, or checks it, right? So, therefore, we'll say that, but actually if you make an analysis of your anger, you will find that you haven't got a good reason to be angry, right? So analysis is useful because it helps to show a mistake, saying you thought you had a good reason when you didn't, huh? But your reasons actually contradict each other. So, therefore, you can see now, I'm saying that fundamentally perception is immediate, even of reasons, and as well as artworks and various other things, but there's an illusion arises, which is that, see, the person who is intuitive is very often, who thinks he is intuitive, is very often using value judgments. Because a value judgment, which is tacit, is felt as an immediate intuitive perception, right? Say a person is prejudiced, he feels he intuitively sees the bad nature of this person, right? Isn't that clear? He doesn't see that he has a reason behind it. That he say all people of this nature, we all know, no, everybody has said all people of this kind are such and such, and all that, right? So therefore, intuition is often rather the other way around. Value judgments are often mistaken for intuitive perceptions. Which gives them great power.
Everything seems like a value judgment, sort of related to all that meaning and stuff that you're talking about. Yeah. The way we relate to each other is through value judgments and stuff.
Yes, well then we're not related if we were related by such a thing, we might as well be related by computer programs, you see. You see, the... you see, these value judgments, there's no reason, they may accidentally be correct in some cases, but there's no reason why they should be, right? Because they're not based on actually seeing the actual fact.
We seem to be a step away from them, sort of protect us from the fact.
Yeah, well, we may want to protect our value judgments and so on, you see, and so on. We'll have to go into the reason for that. You see, because we already mentioned one reason, that a sense of high value makes you feel good. And then eventually, you have the high value also of feeling good. Therefore, the high value of feeling good will entrain the need to protect your value judgment about the other thing. right? You say, if you say, I have a great work of art in my possession and it makes me feel good, and but feeling good is also very valuable. If somebody questions the value of that great work of art, I won't feel so good, right? And therefore, I say he's wrong, right? I deny his statement, and I say the opposite, you know, that this is a very valuable piece of work because I must continue to feel good, right? His evidence no longer counts with me, right?
Most of us are judging each other by the kind of clothes and the kind of vehicle and the kind of houses and the kind of possessions.
Well, that's because our society, those are basic values in our society, right?
And that's how we relate to each other.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, but that's the way the society is working. It's a plain fact. You see, so therefore, we have these value judgments. And now the thing to notice is how this value judgment is very fast. It's too fast to be so for you to make the connection that I was asking for, to have proprioception, to see the thought producing it.
Right. As soon as you have this value judgment, you move forward or shrink away. Or
yeah, you may not even be conscious of the thought. It was long ago, or else you never even had it. Other people had it for you, right?
You have to make it each time, don't you?
The judgment works like a computer program, right? It's, some people had the thought, you know, that this is valuable. Many people have had it. Clothes are valuable, manners are valuable, this is valuable, that is valuable. It was taught to the child and so on, often by example. He may not have thought it out. And then the judgment works automatically, right? It disposes the person to act accordingly.
But it's being made each time.
It acts each time. It has been made long ago. No, the judgment has been made long ago, perhaps before you were. It may have been made long before you were born.
It isn't being made, but it is acting each time.
Yeah.
Mechanical response.
What?
It's a mechanical response.
Yeah.
David, isn't it essentially like a habit? I think I've seen that a habit, the reason I like habit, wrongly, is that it's so quick. It's so fast, and it's
well, it is a kind of habit of thought, isn't it?
Right.
You see, so
program that runs, and it's one that hasn't gotten me killed before, and it's pretty, you know, sort of fits more or less, and so I can use it.
Well, it fits into this society because it was made to fit, right? But for the society as a whole, it leads to disaster, you see, so in the long run. Now, the point is, we have this value judgment. It is very fast, and I would ask a question. I don't know if we can answer it at this, you know, in this seminar. Which is it possible to suspend a value judgment? Often you're asked to suspend judgment, you know, before, and that's obviously a good thing to do, right? To be able to examine the situation. If you could examine the situation, then your judgment is suspended and it will then form properly, right? But if your judgment is that fast, you can't examine it. You see, but you're not bothered by that because you're treating it as an immediate perception of value, right? Intuitive or whatever you want to call it. Now, but can one suspend a value judgment?
If you see it as adding more mud, then maybe you can.
Yes, but it's very fast. You see, it may require, you know, a lot of work on it. You know,
well, you mentioned it earlier, did you, or said something like that judgment is adding to a fact.
Yes, it may be in many cases you add to the fact something that should be added, right?
But maybe there are times where adding to facts is dangerous, like adding something to a mixture may cause an explosion, so you have to be very careful what you add to facts.
Well, it must be correct. You must have added what is correct, you see. That is, the use of judgments, of a series of judgments, say in mathematics, you use a series of train of reasoning, which you may add to the fact, you see, you're drawing conclusions, right? And that's all right. If you make a mistake in the mathematics, you've added something that may lead you astray. Now, the so therefore you can't trust it just because it's an equation, right? Now, the but if you make a mistake in a judgment about, you know, or a series of judgments about people, this can be very dangerous, right?
Could you help yourself by asking yourself, after each one of these decisions, is this a value judgment?
Well, first, become aware that you're making value judgments. Let's put it that way.
But you see, I'm not aware that I've made a value judgment. It just comes out bang, and there I'm stuck.
Well,
I've already made it. But
but can you go?
I catch it after the fact.
You can catch it after the fact and say I've done it, right?
Yes, I'm saying if I ask the question, have I made a value judgment? Then I can look at it. I can take a chance on it.
Yeah, you can look.
Well, that contributes then to interrupting them, stopping them.
Well, that's the first step to realize you're making them, right?
Yeah.
any other way than to ask a question afterwards.
Is there after a while you begin to realize you're making a lot of value judgments, you see, but they still work very fast.
See, that's the way I was able to solve the problem of habit, is to say, is this a habit? Have I, if I just responded with a canned program? And I've said, my God, I did.
Right. Now, you see, therefore we've got these value judgments, you see, after a while you may begin to see them slowing down a little bit, so you can see that the thought is producing them, right?
Is there any other way?
I don't know. You see, maybe there's another way, but say this is a way. I'm not saying this is going to solve anything. We're not discussing solutions here, but merely exploration, right? No, that's a key point. So we have got to suspend value judgments. Let's say we see the necessity anyway of suspending value judgments. Perhaps we don't know how to do it, but we can at least be aware we're making them and pay attention to it and try to pay attention to how it happens, right? For you could try to do the thing over as you did with anger, right? To try to find, express the words which constitute the value judgment and see if it does something to you.
I've noticed that when I make a value judgment, I'm often stuck with the residue of that value judgment in the face of the facts that come subsequent to it.
Yeah.
I've made a commitment to this value judgment. It doesn't allow me to see the truth of what's like about a person. I say, well, that guy's a jerk. That's a value judgment.
Yeah.
Now, subsequently, I come in a relationship and find out that this person is not a jerk, but he's very likable and or whatever. But in that case, either I alter that value judgment and accept this person and realize I made one, or else I can't really perceive because I've given my energy to this judgment more than I have to my perception.
Yeah, that judgment is still being held because it's in part of a web and a web of judgments, of entrained and entangled judgments, right?
It's a kind of frozen energy.
But it's frozen in by a vast web. It depends on other judgments.
Right. The judgment that I'm always right.
Heaven knows how many judgments, you see. So it doesn't easily change, right? See, it's still part of the same structure.
The facts are always challenging our judgments, and so we have to spend a lot of energy refusing to see this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we maintain it through our maintenance of it. You know, we give an energy. And we've all made a value judgment about something like that's no good. It's not somebody hands you the wrong tool, you say it's not going to work, and you find it's working, you sort of feel like you've created a kind of energy that was not conducive.
Yeah, we see that every value judgment liberates energy or affects your energy because values are essentially the liberators of energy, right? Value means strength, right? Yeah, value means strength, power, right? Energy. So values are what liberate energy, you see.
Right.
They're very dynamic. They are not merely words, right? They're not merely thoughts.
All right.
Although they're an extension of the process of thought, but not just intellectual thought, right? You see, so therefore values are going to produce energy, and then this energy may have some meaning to you and a value also. And you may not want to give up that energy, and therefore you don't want to give up the value, right? You see, values affect each other. As I said, values can be valued.
Isn't there the danger in giving up a value to substitute it for another value, even though it may be diametrically opposed? I mean, I've seen people who maybe were raised a certain way, and all of a sudden they have been looking at their value system and decide it's all wet. And so then they go the other way, and their value system says that everything that they used to know, then they automatically make that value judgment in the opposite way.
But it's still the same process, right? You see, that I'm suggesting something entirely different, which is to suspend all these value judgments and examine the situation afresh, right?
Can we do that?
Well, that's my question.
Give us an example of something that we could use to do that.
Well, you see, you have to explore it. I mean,
you have to begin by suspending all values.
Right? If you could, but see, so you'll find they're all connected, you see, but suppose we began with a particular value, I don't know.
I just mean, are we trying to suspend value judgment but keep perception of value, or are we trying to suspend the whole?
Well, you see, I don't think you can stop the perception of value because that's part of what is, right? You see, the value judgment which gets in the way can be suspended, at least that we suggest, right? Now, some value judgments may be useful in some limited area, you see, but you know, but in general, value judgments are of this nature, and can they even those that are useful, they have to be suspended from time to time so you can examine whether they're still useful, right? And so I'm just exploring, is it possible to suspend value judgments? I see the necessity of it, right?
Much of language seems to be a value judgment.
What?
A whole bunch of our language seems to be a value judgment.
It's all around us, you see, but can it be suspended? We're not going to get rid of it, and we're not going to oppose it with another set, and we are not going to just simply try to put it in abeyance. Do you see? Putting your value system in abeyance is not going to help us, because you will be right back in it as soon as you're finished with that, right?
So we need to perceive it in action.
Yeah.
The recognition that we've made a value judgment is not another value judgment?
It can be a perception. It could be a value judgment saying, you know, we've been making value judgments and I now make another judgment, which is I should stop making them, you know, that it's bad to make value judgments, right? Mm-hmm. See, that's why I say let's suspend value judgments and examine them.
And when we do that, then we can better relate.
Well, certainly we'll be able to, that removes a great deal of the mud which is in our spectacles, right? Value judgments are one of the principal sources of this mud, right? Like prejudice, for example. Anybody with prejudice, we could say he's got mud on his spectacles, right?
And prejudice is a value judgment, right?
Yeah, it's a value judgment. It's the very word says so, prejudgment, prejudice.
Suspend sounds like it means throw out.
No, says hold back. Suspend means to hang, you see. It's kept hanging.
You also use the word delay there, just delay.
Well,
it's the same thing as suspend, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but delay implies that we are going to have it sooner or later. Suspend means I may or may not make it.
Okay.
You see, it's pending, you see. Right? Pending means hanging, like a pendulum, right? And the, the thing is that the value judgment is suspended, right? And that's easier said than done, because I'm saying let's consider it. You see, we're exploring it. I'm not saying we're going to solve it. I'm not saying I have solved it. I see the necessity of it, right? This is something creative that we've got to learn.
The old phrase, awareness without choice?
Well, that's the same thing. You see, value is a choice. You see, all choice depends on value, right? Now, if you're full of value judgments, whatever you see is going to be colored by those values and by those choices, right? If your value judgments were all suspended, then perhaps you could see a fact without being colored by false values, right? Now, so as long as your value judgments are operating that way, you're not going to see a fact properly.
One of the problems is how to see. If one was to say, "I want to see my value judgments,"
they've got to be a fact.
They would these value judgments just show themselves through the willingness to look at them?
Or no. I'm saying we've got to see the value judgments as a factual process, too. Without value judgments.
When I see the necessity of suspending value judgments, is that also a value judgment?
No, it could be, but I'm saying if it is, that's unfortunate, you see.
It seems like one of the problems is that this happens so fast that we're not aware of the process.
Exactly.
And maybe by putting it in suspension, we can slow it down long enough that we can get a look at it.
Yes, that's what I'm suggesting. If we could somehow manage to suspend it, we would see it happening as a process, like we said, with proprioception in this pipeline. Right, and then the value judgment itself would be a fact, would be the perception of a fact, right? See, we would turn value judgments into facts.
The fact being that I'm having a value judgment.
Yes, and the value of such and such a nature, right?
Right.
You see, people are arguing about facts versus values, but you see, that's too simple. That value judgments may themselves be treated as facts, and facts depend entirely on values. So there's no sharp separation of fact and value the way some people like to say. No? So you've got to be very clear about values before you can see a fact properly. Yeah.
Well, that's true. We use those things. We make them all the time. The consciousness, like you say, consciousness of the fact that we are making them. George Bush is a wimp, and Reagan doesn't care about the poor, and Ginsburg is a dope head. You know, we do this all the time, and if it does get in the way, something terrible.
Yes, then you see that we therefore don't see facts, right? Right. Now, yes, so I'm saying these value judgments we've got to get hold of somehow, you know, and treat them as facts, which means seeing them as perceiving them and what's actually happening when we make a value judgment, right? Seeing the whole process in action. And I don't want to go in, you know, I think. We could explore this a lot further, but there are other things which I think we should also go into. And one of them is the self-image. I call it the self-world image, which is one of the things behind the difficulty of seeing any of this, right? And you see, everybody has got a self-world image, right? I say the self-image includes, you know, a notion of what sort of person you should be, or what a person should be, what you are. You know, how you're related to other people, you know, what your strong and weak points are, you know, what you like and dislike. It also includes an image of the body and an image of the world in which the body has its existence and its security or insecurity, right? An image of society, and as an image of the mind and the spirit and the soul, and so on. In other words, it's an image of the whole world within which is yourself and other people, and the images of other people, right? It's a world of images, right? Imagination. But it's not like, not just a television image, it's more like a fantasy, or more like the image that an actor makes when he's acting a role, right? We'll have props all around in reality. It will sort of mix with reality, this image. So it sort of fuses. Now, so you see, you can, like we were saying, that reality, is, for the infinite, reality is a particular kind of fantasy. But it's the other way around also. Fantasy is a particular kind of reality, right? Is that clear? You have to see it both ways. That fantasy is a real process, and you have to see it as a fact, right? So we have this self-world image experience as a fantasy with the feeling that there is me, and the image of me experiencing the image of the body and the world, right, and other people. There's a whole world there. In a dream, of course, you see it's a whole world, right? But in an ordinary experience, it is fused with real things, right? As which are, if we're living in the image, the real things are props for the image, right? Now, this self-world image is very powerful. You see, one point is it deals with the whole of existence, right? It's so powerful and fast. It's full of value judgments, which are very fast, right? A sense of truth and reality. And also, any whole, anything dealing with the whole would have very high value, right? Wholeness has a very high value. That's why, say, the nation, if it's regarded as a complete whole, it will be regarded as a high value, right? If you regard this whole thing as, this image as a whole, then it will automatically have high value. You have a very powerful value judgment there saying this is very high, or even supreme value, right? Now, this is a serious difficulty because it means you cannot get the other values and priorities right because the priorities are dominated by the needs of this image. For example, as we were saying, if the image is that you are such and such a person and that you're living in such and such a society and all this creates a sense of high value in you with also good feelings which have high value and so on, then becomes very hard to change any of that because as you begin to change it, you begin to feel worse, right? And therefore, but your other value judgment that this feeling, this center of me is a very high value, takes over and says, this is first, we've got to first see to it that I feel all right, and then we'll see about the other things. And therefore, you choose your thoughts that will make you feel all right. And therefore, self-deception. Now, the whole thing doesn't work. So the whole thing is designed to constantly spatter mud on the spectacles of perception, right? The self-world image, right? Whether it ever had any use, I don't know. You see, it probably has some use, you see, in the sense that we need a kind of self-world image to guide us, right? A kind of map, right? And to know where we belong and how to go, you know, what we do and what sort of things are we, what sort of person you are, what you do and what don't do and all that. But it begins to be so powerful and pervasive, so full of values, that it takes over. And it makes all the other values impossible to get straight. And these because it's based on value judgments, it's extremely fast. You don't see it happening. Right? It comes out as truth and reality.
Is the self-image the same as ego?
The word ego, it depends how you want to use language, you see. Words can always be used in different senses. Now, we can say the self-world image is the ego. That's one way of using language. It's a common way, right?
The self-world
image. Yes, because there's no self-image without a world image. And the self-image is identified with the world image. You see, if you exist in a certain world, if that world is threatened, the self is threatened, right? You're inseparable, right? If there's an earthquake, you know, you can see that going on, that everything is threatened, and therefore you too, right?
You mean, is it because a self-image implies a background?
Yes, it implies a whole world in which the self has its is unfolded, it has its existence and its security and its meaning and so on. Without the world, what would the self mean?
There could be a real self-world image.
Well, there could be an accurate self-world image.
Like one could say that maybe the Indians living, from what we've heard about them, had a sort of a self-world image that was in relationship with the natural world, and then now we seem to have one that's almost totally psychological.
Yeah, well, even then they probably had some false features of that. You see, that, for example, the early peoples had images of gods who might get very angry at them and punish them and so on. You see, that's part of their world, right? You see, that... Now, the gods give part of the meaning of that world, right? Therefore, but that meaning is yourself, right? Whatever the world means to you is you. The power of that meaning is you, right? If the world has no meaning to you, you have no power. You're dead, right? Therefore, the meaning of the world is the meaning of yourself and the power of yourself, right?
And vice versa.
The self-image and the world image can never be separated. There's no meaning to a self-image without a world image.
Well, what kind of a world image do we have?
Also, do we distinguish between our self-world image and the world?
Yes, that's another question. Our self-world image might be taken as a map of the world or a representation of the world, but we take it as the world, right? And the self. No, that's the key point. If we knew we had it, it would not be a serious problem. See, if you know you've got a map, you can say it may be a good map, it may be a bad one, but I can look at the real territory and see how good it is. But it may misguide me. But if I take the map to be the territory, you see, it won't work. Now, see, we have a self-world image, but we don't treat it as a self-world image. We treat it as a self-world.
Judgment's part of that self-world
image. Yes, because that's what gives it the power. That's why it works on its own without our having to do anything about it. It works so much on its own that we say it has all the characteristics of reality. You see, it doesn't need us to help it. It just goes, right? It works independently.
How is perception connected here, then? Is it part of the self-world image?
That's getting in the way. That's a tremendous amount of mud, you see. That is, if the self-world image were known to be a self-world image and seen to be one, it would not cause trouble.
Would be free of it?
Yeah, because you would then take it into account, saying there's my image and there's the reality, right?
So perception has no connection or no relationship
with
self-world image.
Maybe people use some facts originally to make the image which they perceive, but then it got tangled up in this image in fantasy and so on, right?
So the perception that is without the mud.
You
see, that's a self-world image.
Yes, you see, perception is always one, too. You see, if you have mud on the windscreen, you still perceive, but you're perceiving mud, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you suppose it's halfway spattered with mud, and you look through the windscreen, you perceive a world modified by mud, right? If you don't know it's mud, then you perceive a distorted image of the, perceive a distorted perception of the world, right? If you suppose there was no mud on your windscreen, when there is mud, that's the position you'd be in, right? If you know it's mud, the least you can say is, I know that I'm not seeing right, and therefore, fundamentally, it's not confusing me, right?
As long as there's any mud, is there any clear perception?
Well, if you know it's mud, and you see, suppose a part of your screen is spattered with mud, I say, I know it's mud, so at least I know that that is not clear, and I can, some parts may be clear, some may not, and I can take it into account, or I can try to wipe off the mud or something, right? Something I can do. But if I think the mud is not mud, but the world, part of the world, then I have nothing to do, right? What?
You'd be totally lost.
Yeah. So the first thing is to see that mud is mud, not the world, right? Now, the so that's what we've been discussing all the time. That's self-deception, you see. We have been discussing this whole seminar has been looking at that, saying, how do we know, how do we see there's mud? What is, how does it all work? What is the machinery that's spattering it all the time, and so on?
Well, we also do this, I think we can go one farther. There's me, and I project what I am, my self-image on the world, and then you go beyond that, and people do the same thing, I think, when they create God.
That's
there
true.
There may well be one out there, but it would not be me projected on it, so that God has my peculiarities.
Yes.
We see that in the myth. The gods are quite obviously just people writ large, with all their mistakes intact.
Yes, that's very true. You see that the people trying to get beyond this, see, people have said we want to get beyond something so limited, but then they simply think, project part of, they extend the self world image to include God, right?
Don't we sort of go between being God and little orphan Annie?
Yes, it's that extreme, saying little me and great, you know, but that's just jumping, the thoughts jumping to opposites, you see. So. But you see, this question of God is very much connected to the self-world image that, as you were pointing out, and God is, the gods have been projections of human beings writ large, and but there's a sort of an intrinsic connection, you see, much deeper than that, which is appears in the nature of our language. You see, if you go back to the Old Testament, you see the story of Moses, and he came to this burning bush, right? And he, which was the voice of God, right? So he asked God, you know, what is your name? And God says, my name is I am what I am, or I am that I am, right? And then he asked, when I go back to the tribes of Israel, who shall I say sent me? And he says, it says literally, you shall say that, quote, I am sent you. You see, which meant literally that I am is the name of God, right? It just happens that God is, his real name is I am. Now, that is a very good perception, you see. That whatever you would mean by God, you'll mean exactly the same thing by I am. And you say I am just by itself means God, right? It means I, also it can be expanded to mean I, he was, he is, he will be forever, and so on, because that only that could be true of I am, right? And it's written in Hebrew, you can't say I am, you would have to say his name is actually I will be, right? I will be whatever I will be. So the I think that is a perception. The word I am implies something of supreme value. That which is, right? All that which is now and forever. And nothing could have higher value than that.
is that which is? We don't know.
We don't know. But also, as far as I am, is that which we don't know, too, right? So you have this, and now we can now say I am, which has supreme value, but we now call it, each person calls himself I am, right? I am, but he just adds another bit to it and says, I am Mr. X, right? But the first word is I am, right? It's a value, it implies a value judgment of supreme value.
Joke? Was it a joke?
No, it's no joke. It's true. It's a fact, right? It's a fact that I am implies supreme value, you see. And also, the very place the self is in the self-world image is the center, the apparent creator, everything. It all backs it up, right? For the infinite, it must be overwhelmingly powerful. It seems that there's some natural way in which we would come into this sort of problem, right? There's some tendency, yes, to give this supreme value to I am. And then you say, I am Mr. So-and-so, I am X, I am here, I am this or that. And then that that puts the unlimited into the limited, you see. It creates a conflict, right? And we'll discuss that. I think that this is about the right time, right?